Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a remembrance of Senator John McCain, who died on Saturday, a few days short of his 82nd birthday, and speak with Norm Ornstein, a contributing editor for The Atlantic and co-author of One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, The Disillusioned, The Desperate, and The Not Yet Deported. He led a working group of scholars and practitioners that helped shape the law known as McCain-Feingold. And we will discuss how, now that the GOP has been captured by Trump, John McCain appears to be among the last of an endangered species of Republicans who are principled and patriotic. With McCain gone and Senators Corker and Flake retiring, there are very few Republican senators left who are willing to stand up to Trump and defend traditional Republican values and the legacy of the party of Lincoln at a time when the leader of the GOP is acting and talking like a mob boss as the ugly truth about his associates and business practices emerge. We'll assess whether this is a moment for the silent majority to speak out against the tyranny of a vocal minority inside the alternative universe of Fox News, who seem willfully blind to the growing evidence that America's president is compromised by a hostile foreign power, and that the Trump Organization's business model is and was laundering Russian mob money via cash deals through shell companies which bought 1,300 Trump condos for Russian investors. Then we'll go to Ireland and speak with Susan McKay, an award-winning Irish journalist and author of Bear in Mind, These Dead. She joins us to discuss her article at The Guardian, What Will the Pope Have to Say Now That Ireland's Dirty Secrets Are Out, and how Pope Francis dealt with the onslaught of criticism from Irish Catholics and victims of sexual abuse by clergy, punished further by the subsequent cover-ups by the church hierarchy. We will get a report on the Stand for Truth rally and criticism leveled at the Pope to stop praying and do something about the ongoing crisis in the church. Then finally, we will discuss the warning by the former head of security at Facebook, Alex Stamos, who wrote a blog post last week, "It's too late to protect the 2018 elections, but here's how the U.S. can prepare for 2020. David Carroll, a professor of media design at the New School, who explores the intersection between media design, culture, politics, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism, joins us to discuss whether Russia will meddle in the midterms to help Trump as they did in 2016. And joining us now is Norman Ornstein, a contributing editor for The Atlantic, a contributing editor and columnist for The National Journal, and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's the author of numerous books, including the New York Times bestsellers It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann. Now in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. And his latest book with Thomas Mann and E.J. Dionne is One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norman Ornstein.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Norm. And I must say, I feel really sad about what happened. I feel even sadder about what's happening to the country. It feels like the last of something good has passed as we seem to be mired in something that is bad and is getting worse.
No doubt about it. And you know, I was reflecting over the last few days, knowing I knew John McCain pretty well, and I worked with him quite closely on campaign finance reform and some other reform efforts. And I spent enough time with him one-on-one and watching him over the time I first met him when he was Navy liaison back in the early 1980s, that if McCain had ever been elected president, his two runs, of course, fell short, and it's interesting that he's asked the two people he lost to give eulogies at his funeral. But if he'd ever been elected president, I think he would have been a superb president. He would have had integrity, deep concern for every American, including the most vulnerable and the least among us. He would have put excellent people in place. He would not have tolerated corruption or sloppy governance. And every part of that is a contrast with what we have now. And, you know, McCain, as I've watched the cable news coverage and the network coverage over the last day or two, they regularly put up that now iconic scene from C-SPAN when he walked onto the Senate floor coming back from his operations and his health problems and did the thumbs down on the reckless attempt at blowing up Obamacare and replacing it with something that wasn't going to work. As Mitch McConnell glowered at him and the other Republicans' shoulders slumped. And that is an important element of what he did. But the fact is that McCain was almost the only one among Republicans in Congress who stood up not just by a vote, and the others, you have a few who talk but then don't vote to do anything about it, but that speech he gave on the floor about the regular order, about governance and the way it's supposed to be done. We've lost an enormous moral voice and somebody who was never going to be intimidated by Donald Trump or Trump's minions, much less any pressure from the Russians. And that loss, that vacuum, I just don't see anybody filling it right now.
And given that George W. Bush and President Obama, the two former presidents, will give eulogies at the funeral and Donald Trump is not invited to the funeral, do you see this as a possible moment for what I refer to as the silent majority to somehow assert themselves against this vocal tyranny of the minority that we are suffering under?
Well, you know, we're going to face an interesting test now, and that is a test that's going to be there for people who have been McCain's proteges and friends and for whom he was a role model, including his closest friend currently in the Senate, Lindsey Graham, but also for people like Susan Collins and Ben Sasse and Lisa Murkowski and Bob Corker and Lamar Alexander, all of whom were friends and allies of McCain. As we see these accolades come out, some of them focusing on his willingness to stand up against tyranny, will any of them take the cues? And will we see a larger reaction in the country? And that, you know, includes the fact that we got these beautiful responses from George Herbert Walker Bush, from Barack Obama, from Vicky Kennedy, the widow of Ted Kennedy, who died also of a glioblastoma 9 years to the day before McCain did. And then what we get from Donald Trump is a tweet that doesn't even mention McCain. Are we going to see a backlash here, a sense that this just isn't even basic decency being involved and we've got to do something about it? Given McCain's positions, the champion of campaign finance reform, a leader in trying to get bipartisan immigration reform, in trying to get finally criminal justice reform, in pushing for doing something about climate change, a very conservative man who believed in facts, data, science, saw problems, tried to solve them, saw that they had to be done in a bipartisan fashion. Will we find a public that, you know, inculcates some of that now? I don't know, but it's hard to be sanguine right at the moment.
And again, I'm speaking with Norman Ornstein, who's a contributing editor for The Atlantic, a contributing editor and columnist for the National Journal, and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy. He's the author of numerous books, including the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann. Now in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. And his latest book with Thomas Mann and E.J. Dionne is One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. But of course, it was a while back, Norm, when that very opportunity that you just talked about, where people should have expressed their moral outrage, and they did, but not in sufficient numbers, when Trump dismissed John McCain as not his kind of hero because he got captured. That was a shocking moment, but it didn't... It didn't sort of stop the Trump train, did it?
No, and we know that after that, when Trump was asked, having been given the details of the kind of torture that McCain went through for 5.5 years, that he turned down the opportunity to be released early because he knew it was just a propaganda move on the part of the North Vietnamese, and knew from that that the torture would get far more horrendous and he probably wouldn't survive. When told all of that and asked whether he had anything more to say, Trump dismissed it entirely. And we know that he has studiously avoided saying one word about McCain as he's gone through the, you know, terrible ordeal of this brain tumor. It's an evidence of a lack of any level of human compassion, but also any pragmatic notion that it would be the right thing to do and maybe people would see him in a different light. I just don't know whether we're going to see a backlash now, given that we didn't see it with some of the awful behaviors that were evident during the campaign and have been even more evident since the election.
Well, I suppose it's futile sort of indulging in what could have been and what should have been, but certainly his campaign in 2000 was a really interesting one, I thought, and he was only defeated by the worst kind of gutter politics in South Carolina. Do you recall that, Norm?
Oh, of course I do. And, you know, McCain had several children. The most prominent is his young daughter, Megan. But McCain and his wife, Cindy, also adopted a young girl from Bangladesh. And that daughter traveled with him on the Straight Talk Express after McCain won the New Hampshire primary in 2000. He looked like he had momentum heading into South Carolina. And then there was this scurrilous campaign run that suggested that McCain was the father of a black child with pictures of this young daughter conceived illegitimately. And that went everywhere across the state. And most objective observers said that it was instrumental in Bush beating him in South Carolina. Whether Bush himself had anything to do with it, we may never know. It was done independently, as it were. But it almost doesn't matter. It was a terrible, terrible thing, and it was a devastating blow to him. But it also tells you something about McCain, that he later built a relationship with George W. Bush. He was a loyal Republican when Bush was president, although he certainly disagreed with him on some important issues, and that he now, before he died, said he wanted Bush to give a eulogy at his funeral.
So another what-if, Norm Ornstein, is, of course, John Kerry, when he ran against George W. Bush in 2004, he wanted John McCain as a running mate. A cross-party running mate. And given that the biggest political bloc in America are independents, followed by Democrats and then Republicans, that would have been an amazing thing, don't you think? Because I think that would have tapped into something that's really bubbling there, the idea that so many Americans are sick of both parties.
You know, we can look back on many elements of history and wonder about the what-ifs. What if John Kerry and his message sent to John McCain had been accepted? I think there's a very good chance that a Kerry-McCain ticket would have won. And, of course, the scurrilous Swiftboat charges against Kerry, another genuine American war hero, wouldn't have worked very well with John McCain in that position. We know that McCain considered it. But decided that he had been a lifelong Republican and it just wasn't going to work for him. But he also spoke out against those Swiftboat ads and had a very close bond. You know, it's part of that band of brothers with Kerry because of the experiences that they both had on the ground in Vietnam. But we can only look back on that and wonder, and also wonder what might have happened I doubt he would have won in 2008. But if, in fact, McCain had picked Joe Lieberman as his running mate, which he said he later regretted, instead of being talked out of it by his staff and then going with Sarah Palin in a kind of impulsive last-minute decision, what would have happened with history under those circumstances? But, you know, McCain, even though he was a partisan and couldn't give up that Republican identity in 2004, he was always looking to find partners across the aisle. He had this extraordinarily close relationship with Carl Levin, a liberal Democrat from Michigan, when they were both the leaders of the Armed Services Committee, at times when McCain chaired and Levin was the ranking member, and at times when Levin was the chair and McCain was the ranking member. They worked together and found ways to collaborate. You know, my direct role in this was campaign finance reform, and of course there was the famous collaboration between conservative Republican McCain and very liberal Democrat Russ Feingold. And I saw them both together and up close, and it really was an extraordinary bond between the two of them. And I saw it with so many others. And, you know, John McCain always was looking to build relationships with people who were on the opposite sides on so many issues. I'll mention one just before we go. We had a mutual friend named David Ifshin. David, in his middle years, became a kind of Humphrey Democrat, strong on social justice issues and tough on foreign policy. But as a young man, he was a radical anti-war activist who traveled with Jane Fonda to Hanoi, broadcast over Radio Hanoi when McCain heard him in the prison, the Hanoi Hilton. And in 1984, when Ifshin was counsel to Walter Mondale in his presidential campaign, McCain did a very tough commercial ripping apart Ifshin as disloyal, but then felt really badly about it. And as he was going to apologize for somebody who had these strong beliefs about the war and who had acted out of those beliefs, Ifshin came to McCain to apologize. And they built this bond and friendship. And Ifshin, who died of cancer at 46, leaving three young children behind, McCain talked to him almost every day during his ordeal and then delivered a stunning eulogy at his funeral. You know, even for people who were so far from him in some fundamental values, at a certain point, he had enough perspective that he wanted to find out why people felt that way, accept that those were genuine and heartfelt sentiments, forgive things that might have been done that should not have been done, as he knew he had to forgive himself frequently and hope that others would forgive him for his missteps. I've known very few people who have that set of values and carry them out with the kind of courage that McCain did. He was a flawed man, as his choice of Palin would suggest. There are some votes that he regretted casting, but just an incredible person. And, you know, he would have been missed at any time leaving the Senate, leaving public life, leaving the earth. But now, with the challenges that we face and with a Republican Party that is not even a shadow of what it was when he first came into the House of Representatives, the loss is immeasurable.
Well, Norman Ornstein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
Well, thank you again. And I've been speaking with Norman Ornstein, a contributing editor for The Atlantic, a contributing editor and columnist for The National Journal, and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's the author of numerous books, including the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann, now in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. And his latest book, with Thomas Mann and E.J. Dionne is One Nation After Trump, a guide for the perplexed, the disillusioned, the desperate, and the not yet deported. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and go to Ireland to look into some of the criticism leveled at Pope Francis to stop praying and do something about the ongoing crisis in the Catholic Church.
He summoned all of its strength in a climb. It suffered all of its strength in a fall. Sometimes when he got into fighting, man, he could fight with you all day long. He was a good man, and now he's gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Ireland is Susan McKay, an award-winning Irish journalist and author whose books include Bear in Mind These Dead and Northern Protestants, An Unsettled People. She writes for publications including The Irish Times, The Guardian, The London Review of Books, and The New York Times. And her latest article at The Guardian is What Will the Pope Have to Say Now That Ireland's Dirty Secrets Are Out? Welcome to Background Briefing, Susan McKay.
Hello.
So, Susan, can you answer your own questions now that you've seen the Pope and been at all the rallies?
Yeah, well, I actually didn't personally go to see the Pope because I chose instead to go and attend the Stand for Truth rally, which was a sort of demonstration on behalf of the many victims of child abuse and other cruelties perpetrated by the Church in Ireland over the years. But I know 130,000 people did go to Mass in Phoenix Park in Dublin this afternoon, which is a lot of people, but if you think about it, it's actually only about a tenth of the number of people who went in 1979 to see his predecessor, Pope John Paul II, back in 1979. So it did indicate quite a decline in Catholic devotion to the Pope in Ireland. The view taken by many of the survivors of abuse in Ireland is that they're a bit sick of apologies. They got apologies over the years from various figures, including popes and other high figures in the Catholic hierarchy, but it hasn't actually resulted in any meaningful action against those who have carried out abuse, or also nobody has actually stood up and said, okay, anybody out there in the clergy who has either perpetrated abuse against a child or carried out any kind of cruelties on human beings, or anybody who covered it up, or anybody who knows about it and hasn't done anything about it, should now come forward. And what's more, they should come forward to the police in whatever country it happened. And that's not being said. So in some ways, people are sort of saying, well, we kind of don't really want your apologies. They're a bit late, and they're not that meaningful to us. What we want is to make sure this never happens again, and that those who did it and covered it up are held accountable.
Well, I understood that some of the people that met with the Pope, including a well-known priest who was molested at the seminary by an older priest, one of the people in attendance said point blank to the Pope, you know, why don't you stop praying and start doing something about this crisis in the Church?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you heard?
Yes, I believe that was said, and I believe people were rather taken aback as well to discover that the Pope didn't appear to know about many of the very particular types of institutions that we had in Ireland. You know, there was a whole range of punitive institutions here. There were the Magdalen laundries, which young women were sent to who got pregnant outside of marriage. There were the mother and baby homes where women were sent to have babies, which were then taken from them and in many cases sold into America and other places in adoptions, which were very lucrative for the Church. The Pope didn't appear to know about the detail of these kind of institutions, and you would have thought, given the amount of controversy there's been about this visit, that he might have been briefed before he met with those people. They were a very mixed group of people who met with him. Some were more satisfied than others, but I think on the whole, yes, that particular statement does reflect what people felt, just that it's time to actually act now.
Well, what is so troubling, and just I've seen the documentaries about the laundry, is the idea that within these kind of grey walls where atrocities were committed over decades, there are also these unmarked graves.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's how the... I was working as a journalist in Dublin at the period in the 1990s when it came out about the first things that have started to come out about unmarked graves. And that happened, in fact, because the family of an elderly lady who lived in a very poor part of Dublin talked about the fact that the church had just sold this land which was attached to a convent, and it turned out that there were unmarked graves there, and then it turned out that they were graves of Magdalene women who had simply slaved for the church all their lives because they got pregnant as young women and had then just been buried in unmarked graves. And that was one of the first sort of intimations that we had that there was a scandal there. And of course, you know, over the 1990s and since the 1990s and coming up right until today, more and more scandals have emerged. And I think there's a very strong feeling among people that we haven't heard the last of this, that there are still plenty of other dark and dirty secrets to come out.
And again,
it's very interesting, you know, the way that even, you know, public figures here, like our president, President Michael D. Higgins, and our Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, have challenged the Pope as well. You know, President Higgins was the first, the Pope went straight to a courtesy visit with the President on his arrival, and the President issued a statement afterwards telling us what he had said to him, and he said that he talked about how the achievement of an I'm just quoting from him here, the achievement of an equality of rights defined a republic, and how acts of exclusion, including those based on gender and sexual orientation, had caused and were still causing great suffering. So, you know, he was actually really challenging the Pope in terms of, you know, we have a republic here, these are the values that we espouse, and those do not include gender and sexual bias and discrimination. I suppose there's a mixture of feelings here. Some people are satisfied that the Pope has issued a kind of apology and has said that he begs forgiveness for the misdemeanors of the church over the years. Other people, probably, you know, mainly including, say, feminists and more politically minded people, are sort of saying, well, you know, the church preached a twisted morality, and that is going to produce people who have twisted judgment. And, you know, there's something so depraved and perverse about the sorts of things that the church did here. You know, the thousands of children abused in, you know, behind altars and in presbyteries. And, you know, Colm O'Gorman, who's one of the leading figures in that Stand for Truth demonstration today, he was abused by a priest while he was a very, very pious young teenager. You know, so in some ways, the type of people who got preyed upon were actually, in many cases, sometimes people who were themselves profoundly religious, and that compounds the hurt and the pain, because people lost their faith as well as losing their innocence. And many, many people are known to have killed themselves in Ireland because they simply couldn't live with the pain of remembering the things that were done to them, and the fact that until relatively recent years, Ireland just didn't talk about them.
Tell us about the demonstration, Stand for Truth. In your article, of course, you mentioned some of the chants that people have in Ireland have recited, including "Get your rosaries off our ovaries."
Yes, that was a chant that feminists used to use on demonstrations for reproductive rights. Get your rosaries off our ovaries. And after the referendum this year, in which we overwhelmingly voted in Ireland to legislate for abortion to be available to women in quite a liberal way, I remember talking to some friends afterwards and sort of agreeing that we did have a certain feeling of lightness about our bodies, which we agreed felt a bit like that the rosaries had gone off our ovaries. But, you know, it has been a long, long struggle to break down the power of the church in Ireland. You know, the church did have a favoured place in the Irish Constitution in 1937. That was removed in 1973 by referendum, but the church has continued to have a disproportionate influence. And even today, when it has very much less power, it still has a lot of control over education. So, for example, children on the whole have to go to Catholic schools. There's very little choice in most parts of the country. And while they're not quite as overtly Catholic in their practices in many cases as they used to be, in areas where there's a shortage of spaces in schools, people who are Catholics and who can prove that they go to Mass do still get preference. So the church is not quite as disempowered as a lot of people believe it is. The event today I found it very moving. There were a lot of people there who actually, you know, were victims of abuse, survivors of abuse, and or families of people who were survivors of abuse. And indeed, there were a lot of people there who were relatives and friends of people who did not survive, you know, the people who just simply couldn't live with the pain. I spoke with one woman there who is a community worker in some of the most impoverished parts of Dublin, places where the heroin epidemic, for example, has taken a dreadful toll on the young populations over the last number of decades. And she said that she has no doubt whatsoever that a lot of the damage that she has seen in those areas has been down to either people who directly experienced some form of clerical abuse or cruelty, or that it was in their families, like, say, their grandmother had been in a Magdalene laundry or their father had been in an industrial school, you know, that the damage is still there and it's moving through the generations. And Colm O'Gorman, who I referred to earlier, spoke of it today as being, it wasn't just the absence of love that damaged people, it was the fact that they were made to believe that they were unlovable, that they didn't deserve to be loved, that it was impossible to love them. And, you know, people were saying, just talking to people in the crowd who knew people who'd been abused, were saying that, you know, they were told by priests that it was their fault, that they had provoked it, that there was something about them that, you know, they had, in the same sort of way that women who are raped are told that they are responsible for it. Mm-hmm. You know, children who were raped were told that it was them who had provoked it. So there's a lot of very, very strong feeling and sorrow and anger going around. And somehow or other, people just didn't find what the Pope said adequate to deal with that. On the other hand, I did speak to quite a few people, you know, coming away from, who had been to the Mass in Phoenix Park, and they all also mentioned abuse. They all said, yeah, you know, this church has done wrong, but many of them felt that the Pope has said enough and that it's time to put the past behind us. But of course, that's not so easy to do if it's affected your own family directly.
Sure. Well, but the real issue, as we'd mentioned earlier, was, you know, it's one thing to say something, but it's another thing to do something. And that's what led the critic in front of the Pope to say, stop praying and do something. They really haven't done anything much that's meaningful. And we just learned from Pennsylvania the horrors that went on for 70 years with 300 priests abusing at least 1,000 mm-hmm. people. So I just want to get a broader question about the church itself, given that this Pope is somewhat mm-hmm. different. He famously said once, when asked about homosexuality, he said, well, who am I to judge? And of course, he met with the island's prime minister, who is gay and openly so. Mm-hmm. So is there something about the Northern Catholics, Ireland, Poland, Germany, who produced, of course, a very reactionary Pope, both of them, those countries did, and the Italians and the Latin Americans? Is there a difference there?
I don't think I would be able to answer that question. I mean, I don't really actually pay very much attention to popes. I'm not a Catholic, and I've not ever been involved in the Catholic Church in that way. I do feel that people are sort of saying, well, it's all very fine for the Pope to, you know, meet with the gay Irish Prime Minister and so on, and say, who am I to judge? But the fact is, the Church still does judge. I mean, the World Family Gathering was in Dublin this week, and gay families were not included in it. And in fact, you know, gay choirs stood outside of the gates and sang We Are Family and Something Inside So Strong, and, you know, that they made their voices heard in that way. But the fact is, they were excluded, even though we legislated for same-sex marriage in Ireland a few years ago. So there's, and, you know, nobody has ever turned around and said, we were wrong to say that homosexuality is intrinsically disordered or evil, which are all words which are there. So people want the Church to actively dismantle these aspects of the religion before they're going to be willing to accept just words.
Well, it is extraordinary that it goes on, and I'm sure there are more shoes that are going to drop. And one wonders how systemic it is. And one of the things that seems obvious is that this the vows of celibacy aren't working, and maybe that's just too much to ask. So why not let priests marry, and why not ordain women? That would go a long way, I think, to getting rid of this rampant and deadly hypocrisy.
Well, I think a lot of people feel that, and a lot of people feel that for all the sort of remorse that this Pope is uttering, it is only lip service, because he hasn't in any way talked about how the whole sort of male celibate, men-only kind of church from which women are just completely excluded. He hasn't talked in any way that has shown that he has any understanding that that might contribute to what has happened. There's no sense of awareness that women are just not willing to be outside of where decision-making is taken. People were very amused here to discover, bitterly amused actually, to discover that the people who help out, the volunteers who help out at Knock, where the Basilica is that the Pope visited up in the west of Ireland, the men who help out as volunteers are called stewards. The women are called handmaids.
Oh, my God. well, on that.
Do none of these people watch TV? Do they not know that we were all fired up by Margaret Atwood's handmaid's tale on television last year?
Well, Susan, I'm sorry to tell you. I'm sorry to tell you. I wish we could continue, but we have run out of time, and I appreciate your joining us very much.
Okay, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Susan McKay, who is an award-winning Irish journalist and author whose books include Bear in Mind, These Dead, and Northern Protestants and Unsettled People. She writes for publications including The Irish Times, The Guardian, The London Review of Books, and The New York Times. And her latest article at The Guardian is What Will the Pope Have to Say Now That Ireland's Dirty Secrets Are Out? We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the warning by the former head of security at Facebook that it's too late to protect the 2018 elections. But here's how the U.S. can prepare for 2020.
Computer.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Carroll, a professor of media design at the New School, where he explores the intersections between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. His research and analysis examines major shifts in media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Carroll.
Thanks for having me on.
And last week, Facebook's former security chief, Alex Stamos, in response to Facebook removing 652 pages linked to Russian and Iranian hacking and trolling, basically said that this 2018 election will not be protected, and the U.S. had better get its act together because it's going to take at least till 2020 to build defenses. So is that what we're facing now, that we are, the 2018 elections are essentially defenseless against foreign cyber mischief?
Well, it remains to be seen. He's probably focusing on the specific government response and the intelligence community's response and the coordination with the tech platforms that has not been fully developed as necessary. So from that perspective, you know, I would share his concerns, and indeed the the partisan conflict at the moment is a primary obstruction to us being able to resolve this. But I think that the general population, in other words, the electorate, has become more aware of the problem. So I don't necessarily think we are totally defenseless. I think that voters have an awareness that will be our only defense in the midterms, at least.
So Alex Stamos, his blog post was titled, "It's Too Late to Protect the 2018 Elections, but Here's How the U.S. Can Prepare for 2020. And when you say, David, that partisanship is an impediment here, does that mean that the Republicans essentially are invested in this? We know that Donald Trump hasn't done anything. In fact, in front of the eyes of the entire world after the secret meeting with Putin at Helsinki at the press conference, when asked about Russian meddling in the 2016 election, Trump basically sided with Putin. So Putin's been given a free pass. Little wonder Russian activity is increasing and hasn't stopped. But at the end of the day, could you shame the Republicans by saying, you know, you got to be elected fair and squarely. You can't depend on Putin to stop the Democratic blue wave?
Yes, it is an unfortunate moment, and Alex Stamos, you know, makes a reference to it in his piece, basically saying, I'll paraphrase him, but he's basically saying, you know, the Republican Party may feel that the interference has benefited this time, but there's no sense that, you know, they won't be the, you know, victims of it in the future, and that our adversaries, you know, have a sort of equal opportunity strategy, and the strategy is to, you know, attack democracy itself and the electorate's confidence in democracy. So it's a really short-sighted and really unfortunate perspective to not realize that, you know, taking a strong stand against this benefits everyone for the foreseeable future rather than trying to downplay it because the perception is it's been helpful in a very, very troubling way.
So how could a cyber attack or cyber meddling, and by the way, it's ongoing because, as we pointed out, Facebook took down 652 pages of Russian mischief, and I think there's also some attribution to Iran as well, and also Microsoft is also alerted that there's ongoing Russian interference. So how would it manifest itself, though? Would they, do you think, just do what they've been doing of late, which is doing what they did in 2016, creating false identities and trying to spread divisions? The latest thing, apparently, that the Russian troll farms and bots are doing now is pushing this anti-vaccine story, which has some traction amongst delusional Americans. So, again, the device or the idea is to divide and exacerbate already existing social tensions in the United States. So will they continue to do that, or will they go a step further and actually screw with the election itself, perhaps tamper with the voting rolls?
Yeah, there's lots of concerns that the strategy of our adversaries in this domain is to identify fissures in our societies and then stoke them, and it is alarming to see how vaccines have been contaminated with this discourse, meaning the confidence and faith in vaccines has had real effects, meaning we're seeing measles outbreaks now, and it's not just happening in the United States. Apparently, it's happening in France as well. And you can even potentially attach this to the support of the NRA in the sense that, propping up, sort of the gun rights movement, which, has an indirect effect of leading to more violence and more chaos in our country. You can see why an adversary would seek to do that. And Stamos's sort of main thesis is the playbook is out in the wild and anyone can copy it. And what we've also discovered in the sort of unraveling of the investigation, speaking specifically to the special counsel's investigation, who has reportedly been looking into companies like Cambridge Analytica and another company called Psy Group, there's real concern that there's a sort of international industry of companies that are sort of functioning as private intelligence agencies that can be used and hired to use data and media to spread propaganda and discord in a very targeted way. And this includes the creation of imposter and inauthentic social media accounts, the creation of deliberately fake news sites, spreading disinformation as a deliberate strategy. So the idea that the Internet Research Agency Troll Factory is a single entity in the world is really not the case, that there are many companies out in the world operating in this fashion, and the aftermath of the 2016 election and the investigations has uncovered this shadowy industry. So there's many prongs to this problem. To your question about sort of direct intervention in the election infrastructure itself, this is also a really concerning problem because a lot of the rhetoric is, no votes were changed, so we can't attribute this. But on the contrary, it doesn't have to be that kind of impact to have a effect on the election. So, for example, tampering with the voter rolls could create chaos on election day and disenfranchise voters in a very targeted way, and this has an indirect way of changing votes. So we have concerns about that. And I have a personal experience seeing this in the state of New York. I was asked by the New York State Assembly last year to testify about my research into Cambridge Analytica for the purposes of election day and operations and election day defense, and I heard really interesting testimony from members of state election boards across the state of New York. And what struck me was the difference between how a really, a city like New York City, which has really, in some ways, all the money it could need to defend its election board from attacks, and in fact, the head of the election board in New York City described how they had a close to $1 million contract with a third-party cybersecurity firm to protect the city's election infrastructure, and contrast that with the election board testimony of Schuyler County upstate, which experienced a tremendous cyber attack that took down the entire county. And really, these rural counties simply do not have the financial infrastructure to pay, cybersecurity firms what's required to defend the infrastructure. So we also have this problem that the cities have the money to protect their infrastructure, but the cities, tend to vote in one way, and rural areas tend to vote in another way and are woefully underprotected. And so in one way, the elegance of the U.S. system is that the voter infrastructure is completely decentralized, and so there's no way to attack it in a singular place. But the problem with that model is that every local jurisdiction is responsible for its own cybersecurity. And I think one thing that needs to occur at the national level is that all counties are properly funded so that they can afford the expensive infrastructure that's required to protect our infrastructure. Furthermore, you know, our voting equipment is a private industry. So what is the relationship between the private companies that provide infrastructure to the local counties, and what responsibility do they have to shore up their systems and be certified and accountable and transparent in the appropriate ways? These are really tough issues, and what's, I think, difficult about it is there's no one focal point to focus on. It's a combination of decentralized infrastructure and also the realization that information war is part of the problem as well, and that is even more difficult to get our heads around.
So does that mean then that if the cities are better secured, and they tend to be where people vote Democrat, and particularly the cities in the blue states, and rural areas tend to vote Republican, if the Russians wanted, I mean, there's two possible motives for the Russians. One is to protect Trump, because he's the gift that keeps on giving for Putin. I mean, my God, what an amazing thing to have your guy in the White House who's absolutely, you know, is enthralled to you and on the foreign policy stage does your bidding at the expense of America. It's an amazing situation that we have. So I can understand why Putin wants to keep him in, and we don't know what happened in the secret meeting in Helsinki, whether some kind of deal was made. We know that Trump's afraid of impeachment, and he doesn't want the House to change to the Democrats in November. So you can either have two motives, either one to try and get rid of the blue wave, or two, just create chaos and demoralize Americans and divide them from their democratic institutions. So that's always been an ongoing motive of Putin. So I don't know whether he's prepared to go the whole hog, but if, according to what you just said, if the red states are vulnerable, then could they up the Republican count? Would that be a tactic? If they can't reduce the Democratic count in cities, and I probably don't know why they want to do that, because the problem we already have is blue states' votes are diluted because so many people are voting in urban areas, and the rural people have an advantage because of the Electoral College. So can you walk us through a possible scenario here?
Sure. Well, one of my concerns has been the problem that voter registration files in the United States are generally, tragically unprotected data sources. And the worry is that our adversaries gathering data profiles on the entire electorate, more than 200 million people, gives them a data advantage to use data modeling, use the same techniques that political consultants and campaigns use to predict outcomes and target their resources for campaigns. The same techniques can be used to target attacks. So to find local districts that are especially vulnerable to sort of hack the Electoral College. So this is the sort of my concern with the sort of structure of the Electoral College itself, is that because elections are decided on very thin margins, we saw with the 2016 election, it was really three states and really just sort of tens of thousands of votes per state that decided it at the Electoral College. An adversary could model the same way that consultants are, to target specific districts to disrupt, to have the maximum effect. And so I think it comes down to what Stamos recommends in his essay, that Congress needs to get a handle over how campaigns use voter data for its own analytics and micro-targeting, and what are the security considerations related to voter registration files, and how are they restricted. What, you know, some states even have their voter registration files available for download on the website. You can download all of the voter files just publicly. And this seems really reckless to me. On top of the private industry that is collecting voter information and building models on us, and the data breaches that have been discovered in the RNC. So at least two major data breaches in the RNC data have been reported. One last summer, where a company called Deeproot Analytics, its entire voter database was just sitting out in the open for anyone to take. That was discovered by a breach hunter named Chris Vickery. And then more recently, another breach was discovered in Texas, where the Texas RNC data files were found to be breached. So what's really ironic is the DNC is being hacked, and the RNC is just breaching its own data. So we really need to get a handle on the necessity to protect voter registration files as a way that we can be, it's an attack surface. And we know for sure from the Mueller indictments that the Russian intelligence services have been extremely active in a data collection operation and had many different creative ways of harvesting data from unsuspecting American voters in many different ways. And so we have to understand that our data can be used against us. It can be weaponized in ways that we have never before imagined. And I think a key thesis or expression of the Stamos essay is that our infrastructure can be used against us by our adversaries. And we need to wisen up to this. We've been naive in the usual ways, thinking openness and freeness will be the best way to go, but we do need to practice security, and we do need to learn from our mistakes in that way. And that's why I think Stamos's essay is really important and really helpful, because he was really considered the best in the business with regards to the best chief security officer. So it's no coincidence that Facebook was able to have him for as long as they did. It's really telling that he couldn't stay there because reportedly he wasn't pleased with how Facebook responded to the issues, and it weighs heavily on him now. But now that he is sort of free to speak his mind and participate in his academic work now as a faculty and a member and a fellow, he can really shed light on the issues that he saw. And I think he's a really credible voice that people should take very seriously.
Well, just in the last minute, David Carroll, Iran apparently is getting in on the act. We know Russia's been busy for some time hacking and causing cyber mischief. But Iran, of course, was literally attacked by both the United States and Israel with the Stuxnet virus, and that was an overt piece of cyber warfare. So something's obviously changed. Maybe the sanctions against Iran have made them decide to go after the United States. Do you have any thoughts on that just in the last minute?
Sure. I think we really have to understand that cyber war is ongoing. It's unlike any other kind of warfare we've ever experienced in life. And so we have to understand that this is happening, and it's going to require shifts in public attitudes and shifts in policy, and it's going to be an ongoing conflict. I don't think there is a way to there's no silver bullet here. It's a new way of seeing the world, and technology is at the heart of it.
Well, David Carroll, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with David Carroll, who's a professor of media design at the New School, who explores the intersections between media design, culture, policy, industry, and education. His research and analysis examines major shifts in the media as it relates to advertising, ad tech, data rights, privacy, surveillance, social media, and journalism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.